From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Our family arrived at John F. Kennedy Airport last week from an international flight. We are U.S. citizens, but we were held for 6 hours, questioned and searched simply because of our ethnicity and our religion.
Racial profiling. Middle Eastern, South Asian, and Muslim passengers say they're increasingly being detained and harassed at airports. Then we go to Sudan.
In Darfur, over the last 5 weeks alone, we've recorded about 200 cases of sexual assault in one camp, which the International Rescue Committee thinks is indicative of the deteriorating situation, security situation in Darfur.
And Venezuelan President Chavez goes to China. We'll talk about the politics of the trip and Venezuela's effort to become a member of the UN Security Council. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The U.S. State Department has begun investigating Israel's use of U.S.-made cluster bombs in southern Lebanon. The New York Times reports today Israel may have violated secret agreements with the United States that restrict when it can employ such weapons. Three types of U.S.-made cluster munitions have been found so far in southern Lebanon. The State Department has also held up sending Israel a shipment of M-26 artillery rockets, a cluster weapon. During the 80s, the U.S. imposed a six-year ban on sales of cluster bombs to Israel after a congressional investigation determined Israel had used the weapons against civilians during its 1982 invasion of Lebanon. Yesterday, we questioned Israel's deputy ambassador to the United Nations, Danielle Carmon, about the cluster bombing of the Lebanese civilian population.
What I can tell you that Israel abides by the principle of international law and international military law. I don't want to go specifically into details of something that has been written in one report, respectable as it is or not. I'd rather not go into the details.
Well, Israel hasn't denied that it's used cluster bombs in Lebanon, and now after the hot conflict has begun to simmer down. You still have these bomblets on the ground that are exploding.
Well, I didn't deny it either. What I was saying that we are abiding by the international law, the military and the international humanitarian law, and I would leave it at that.
In Lebanon, the long process of clearing areas of cluster bombs and landmines has already begun. This is Frederick Gross of the Mine Advisory Group.
In fact, it's very difficult to say how long we need to recover everything. When we work in a garden, sometimes we found some ammunition from the last war. So it will take many years.
Lebanon's Speaker of the Parliament has accused Israel of waging an economic war on Lebanon. Nabi Berri told the Financial Times Israel's ongoing air and sea blockade is crippling Lebanon's economy. A top European official says international troops could start deploying to southern Lebanon within days. On Thursday, France agreed to send 2,000 soldiers. French Prime Minister Jacques Chirac urged all permanent members of the UN Security Council to contribute troops. But the United States and Britain have already ruled out sending troops. Foreign ministers from the European Union are meeting today in Brussels to discuss the size of the European troop deployment. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan spoke to reporters before the meeting.
I have confidence in Europe. I'm very confident that we will have a successful meeting this afternoon. And Europe will assume its responsibility and show its solidarity with the people of Lebanon and in that region.
Maybe 50,000 people?
50?
50.
And not today, but I'll have a very good start today. But I will get 15,000.
Okay. In other news from Lebanon, the bodies of 23 people were exhumed from a mass grave in Tyre Thursday. The 23 civilians died 2 weeks ago in the Israeli bombardment of the town of Marouin. Meanwhile, Lebanese parents are also reporting their children are still suffering from the 34 days of fighting. This is the Lebanese resident Khatarkher Adin.
The kids became very scared of everything after the war. They have become very stressed. They would feel afraid if the electricity went off or if any strange sound appeared in the house. They have been living in a very difficult psychological state.
The Israeli military chief of staff has acknowledged that there were considerable logistical, operational, and command shortcomings during the recent attack on Lebanon. In a letter to Israeli troops, Lieutenant General Dan Chalutz said the military's response will be investigated. The New York Times is reporting some senior Bush administration officials and top Republican lawmakers are accusing the intelligence community of playing down the threat posed by Iran. Much of the criticism is coming from Republicans who advocated for the invasion of Iraq. On Wednesday, the House Intelligence Committee issued a report criticizing the intelligence community for not knowing more about Iran's weapons of mass destruction program and for being unwilling to make provocative conclusions about the danger Iran poses to the world. The consensus of the intelligence community is that Iran is still years away from building a nuclear weapon, but some Republicans have rejected the conclusion. Some veterans of the intelligence community say the current debate is similar to the one that preceded the Iraq War, when backers of the invasion criticized the intelligence community for downplaying the threat posed by Iraq and for disregarding claims that Iraq had ties to al-Qaeda. In other news on Iran, Russia announced today it will not support imposing sanctions against Iran over its nuclear program. In Iraq, the top U.S. general in the Middle East said Thursday there have been, quote, great progress on the security front in Baghdad recently. General John Abizaid made the comments on the same day at least 16 Iraqis and two U.S. soldiers died. Supporters of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr are rejoicing today after British troops decided to abandon their base in the city of Amara. Supporters of Sadr said this marks the first time an Iraqi city has kicked out occupying troops. The British decided to move their 1,200 soldiers after the base came under heavy mortar and rocket fire. The British troops are now preparing to wage guerrilla warfare in the region in an attempt to secure the Iranian border. According to press accounts, this marks the first public acknowledgement that forces from the U.S.-led coalition have entered into guerrilla warfare. The Food and Drug Administration has decided to make the morning-after contraceptive pill, known as Plan B, available without a prescription to people 18 and older. But the FDA decided girls 17 and younger will need a prescription to obtain the pills. Plan B will only be available from pharmacists at drugstores and health clinics. Purchasers will be required to show proof of age. The decision ended a three-year battle within the FDA. In Gaza, kidnapped journalists Ken Santani and Olaf Wieg have entered their 11th day in captivity. That's Steve Santani. Suspicion is growing that the men were kidnapped by foreign militants. All of the major Palestinian factions have called for the men to be released. This is Ken Santani's brother, Steve.
By now you know they cherish life. They have no power. They are not deal makers. They are not politicians, and they have no authority. Our brother and his colleague are in Gaza to report your story. Nothing more and nothing less.
Ken Santani, Steve's brother. Federal agents have arrested a New York man for broadcasting the Lebanese TV station Al-Manar inside the United States. Javed Iqbal was arrested Wednesday. The Pakistani-born man is being held on $250,000 bail, faces at least 5 years in prison. In March, the State Department designated the TV station to be a terrorist entity because of its links to Hezbollah. Iqbal runs a small television company in Brooklyn that installs satellite receivers across New York. He was arrested after an FBI informant attempted to have Al-Manar installed on his satellite system. A federal judge has ruled the government can legally tap the phones of anyone handling, quote, material that's not generally available to the public. Privacy experts say the ruling by Judge T.S. Ellis opens the door for the U.S. government to monitor journalists. Stephen Aftergood, who edits the journal Secrecy News, said, quote, if the press could only report on information generally available to the public, there would be no need for a press. The ruling came in the trial of the two former AIPAC lobbyists who are accused of receiving classified intelligence from a Pentagon official. School children across the United States have given more money for Katrina relief efforts than all but five of the country's largest corporations. According to the group Random Kid, school children have raised over $10 million over the past year through bake sales, lemonade stands, car washes, and other fundraisers. School children gave more to Katrina relief efforts than companies such as AT&T, Verizon, GE, and Coca-Cola. In other news on Katrina, a new report indicates the government awarded 70% of its contracts for Hurricane Katrina work with limited or no bidding. The Shaw Group and Bechtel are among the companies that receive no-bid contracts. Both have close ties to the Bush administration. The Shaw Group's lobbyist, Joe Albaugh, is a longtime friend of President Bush. Bechtel's CEO, Riley Bechtel, served on Bush's Export Council. In news from Louisiana, a school bus driver has been suspended after she forced 9 African-American children to sit in the back of the bus behind the white students. All the students attended the Red River Elementary School in Coushatta, Louisiana. The NAACP says it's considering filing a formal charge with the Justice Department. In other education news, a 7th-grade geography teacher in Colorado was suspended earlier this week for displaying flags from Mexico, China, and the United Nations in his classroom. An obscure Colorado state law prohibits the display of any foreign flag in public buildings and schools. Temporary displays of other flags are allowed, but the school principal did not consider the display in Eric Hamlin's classroom temporary enough. After the case made national news, the school said Hamlin could return to the classroom as long as he keeps the flags up for no more than 6 weeks. In television news, the producers of the reality TV program Survivor have decided it'll start dividing its contestants among racial lines and will let the groups duke it out for supremacy. It will be whites versus blacks versus Latinos versus Asians. CBS admitted the idea is controversial, but denied it's intended to promote racial divisiveness. Critics of the idea say the show will nurture stereotypes and reinforce myths about the inferiority of particular races. And Carrie Ryan has died at the age of 35. To many Americans, she was the symbol of the horrors of Agent Orange. She was the daughter of a Vietnam veteran who'd been exposed to Agent Orange, the dioxin the U.S. military widely used in Vietnam and Cambodia. Carrie was born with multiple birth defects. She had a hole in her heart, 2 cervixes, no anus, a deformed right arm, and spina bifida. In 1979, she was named in a class-action lawsuit against Dow Chemical, the manufacturer of Agent Orange. In Vietnam, millions of people still suffer illnesses and birth defects because of Agent Orange, but the U.S. has refused to compensate the victims. Those are the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country. Well, 12 airline passengers arrested in Amsterdam on suspicion of planning acts of terrorism were released Thursday after Dutch police found no evidence they were about to commit an act of violence. The men were on board a Northwest Airlines flight to India when the crew became alarmed after the men began using their cell phones soon after takeoff and ignored orders to stay in their seats. The pilots turned the flight around and made an emergency landing in Amsterdam to force the passengers off. The 12 men did have one thing in common. All of them were Indian citizens or of Indian descent. The story is just the latest in what appears to be a sharp increase in racial profiling of South Asian, Middle Eastern, and Muslim passengers over the past few weeks. In just a 9-day stretch this month, a total of 5 Arab men and a Pakistani woman were tagged as potential terrorists. All of them turned out to be innocent.
At least one Congress member has publicly called for screening people on the basis of race and religion. Last week, House Homeland Security Chair Peter King endorsed requiring people of Middle Eastern and South Asian descent to be singled out for additional security checks. Well, the Justice Department and Homeland Security say they don't practice racial profiling. More and more cases are popping up around the country that tell a different tale. Last week, a group of Muslim Americans say they were detained for hours at New York's Kennedy Airport when they came back to the United States from trips abroad. 2 of them join us in our Firehouse studio today. Nagham al-Yaqoubi is a U.S. citizen who was born in Iraq and lives in New Jersey. Her daughter, Arwa Ibrahim, is a student at Rutgers University. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Thank you.
What happened?
Well, we were arriving on Tuesday, August 15th at 4:30 p.m. from a flight from Dubai, but it was actually a transfer flight from Jordan where we had spent our vacation. And after we went through customs and the man looked at our passports, we were told to step aside for additional questioning rather than claiming our baggage. We arrived in a small blocked-off area, and we looked around and we saw 200 other Arabs, South Asians, and Muslims with us. We were told to pass up our passports and wait until we were called for questioning. We were held there for around 5 hours, and then we were questioned, and afterwards our bags were searched.
What kind of questions were they asking you?
They asked us I felt very inappropriate questions that they seemed to be recording into their computer. I don't know for what purpose. They asked us about specifics of where we worked, what school I went to, what I majored in, and they also asked us about some of our political views. They asked my sister whether she felt that Iraq was better now or under Saddam's rule, and they were recording everything that they asked
us. How old is your sister?
My sister's 22.
What did she say?
She said, I don't remember Iraq then. But I think this question is so ridiculous because just because you're for the war or against the war, if you're against the war, it doesn't mean that you're suspicious or a terrorist of any kind. And they were recording everything, so to me it seems like maybe they were starting some sort of database. To me, it just made me feel uncomfortable.
How many of you were there?
There were 200 people plus when we were there.
How big is your family?
Our family is 5 people.
And they were you, your sister, your mother?
My other sister and my brother were also there. And through when they were holding us there for the 5 hours, the Homeland Security officers were very rude. They threatened to arrest my mother. They also threatened to hold us longer if we complained. They didn't provide us with enough seating. They didn't provide us with food or water. And whenever we asked if we could have these things, if they could be given to us, they said that it's not their job, it's not the government's job to provide them for us.
Now, they threatened to arrest you for what?
I was just asking the officer to speak nicely to the people instead of yelling at them. And he said, well, I'll arrest you if you don't be quiet.
Did they question you?
Yes. General question about, like, what do I work and why, how long have you been then? And also they ask us if we have any weapon training. Do we fencing?
Fencing?
They said, do we fence or hunt, because that counts as weapons training. Mm-hmm.
And
do you fence?
No. No, I don't, and none of my children do. Yeah.
And the passengers there were from all the various flights that were coming in?
Yes, they were. JFK is saying that they're not racially profiling, that what they're doing is they're just asking further questions of people that are coming from the Middle East. But actually, that's not true, because we had many white passengers on our flight from Dubai that were not further questioned, that were allowed to claim their baggage. So it was very obvious that it was racial profiling.
Did they ask you all together in the group of your sister's brother, mm-hmm. your mom?
Two groups. First, the three of us, me, my son, and my daughter, my older daughter. And then they asked, we left, and they asked Sumaya now. And specifically, she asked me to leave. I really wanted to stay with my other daughters, but she specifically asked me to leave.
I would think that if they were the other two children, were either of them minors at all?
No. Like, the youngest we have is 20. Mm-hmm. So.
And has anything like this happened in the past when you've traveled?
Never.
No. It's never happened before.
We were very surprised, really.
We also called Homeland Security's Customs and Border Protection, invited them on the program. They declined to join us, but we got this email from Public Affairs Officer Eric Blum. Let me just read a portion. U.S. Customs and Border Protection does not use racial profiling. However, CBP officers may scrutinize more closely individuals from high-risk countries. CBP denies entry to thousands of individuals every year on grounds of inadmissibility, some of which include improper travel documents, prohibited activities or intent, traveling under the visa waiver program without qualifying for participation in that program, smuggling of contraband or prohibited goods, criminal activity or history, immigration violations such as prior visa overstay, attempting to gain entry with fraudulent documents or posing as an imposter, watch list match, or national security concerns, among others. It goes on for a while, and it says CBP does not comment on individual cases as this information is protected under the Privacy Act. After 6 hours, what did they say to you?
Nothing. We were just walked out the door. No explanations.
They asked us to go to another line. We're supposed to leave, look at our passport, and leave. But then when you look at our passport again, he said, well, go to the other line. And there, they ask us to open our luggage, and they want to search it. He left us for about 15 minutes. Then he come back. Then he start to search our luggage.
And there was never any apology for the delay or for the five-hour delay that you had there?
Not at all.
No apology, no explanation.
We're also joined on the phone by Omar Mahdi. He is representing Nagham al-Yaqubi and her family and is president of the New York chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Omar Mahdi.
Thank you for having us.
It's good to have you with us. How common is this?
I would say this is common, actually. The difference between now, since August 15 and before August 15, the authorities were relying on the no-fly list. The no-fly list will list all the potential terrorists that are coming to this country. However, the problem is that no-fly list lists people with the name of common names like Muhammad. And there are millions of Muslims called Muhammad. So they would be stopped, and they would be detained for 6 hours, questioned. And it was happening to mostly young men. It was not happening to families that you have in front of you. However, after August 15, it's becoming a trend that all families, it doesn't matter who you are, even if you are a family with children, you will be stopped just because who you are, because you are Muslim, you're South Asian, or you're an Arab. And that is becoming now a trend and a practice, a common practice, that people of that origin have been stopped. And being, to my knowledge as an attorney, when you're stopped for 6 hours and you're not allowed to leave, you're arrested.
Could you talk also about the incident that occurred on August 17th at a tri-state airport in West Virginia?
That one, actually, I would rather not comment on it, but I do know there was an incident. There are many incidents, not only that one, but I would rather not comment on the incident because I don't have all the necessary information for me to comment on that.
And in your organization, what are you attempting to do, given this increased number of incidents now, to be able to assure some kind of decent treatment of Muslim and Arab passengers?
What we are doing, actually, we're gathering data now and trying to get as many information as we can, and then we will have to deal with it, just as we did. We dealt with it at some point with the DOJ was investigating stop and frisk in New York City, NYPD, where they stopped many African American based on their race. And that's something that we are contemplating, and we will be very we will do something about that once we gather all the data and find out what happened.
We're looking at case after case. One this week, a British Muslim airline pilot describing the humiliating moment when he was hauled off a transatlantic flight just before takeoff. His name is Amar Ashraf, born in North Wales, said he felt demoralized and humiliated after being told to leave the flight from Manchester to Newark by a stewardess and then being questioned by armed police. He believes his removal was down to having a Muslim-sounding name. Omar Mahdi, what can people do? What can passengers do?
I will send this message to everyone. Every person who has been stopped has been treated this way, to make sure that they document that and they make sure they will inform civil rights organizations and let them know that's the only way we will be able to find out how many people like that have been detained, have been questioned, have been humiliated. And you have the Council on American Islamic Relations is one of them. You can call them, and there is New York 212-870-2002.
Finally, on the issue of the New York Congress member, Peter King, saying that racial profiling is appropriate, your response?
You know, I think Peter King's comment does not surprise me. 2 years ago, he mentioned that 80% of people go to mosque, they are extremist, and they have no loyalty to this country. So, I mean, his comment, I mean, he wrote a book, and his book was full of defamatory statements against members of the community, which does not surprise me that he will call for racial profiling, which is illegal. It's violating the Equal Protection Clause. Doesn't matter what the situation is. The reason we are here, the reason we are all in different communities in this country, is to get together and try to fight terrorism. But that's not the way to do it. You don't identify a certain group and you say, these people, they are potential terrorists because they belong to a faith. 7 million Muslims living in America, and they cannot say to target them just because they are Muslims. Racial profiling does not work. Behavior profiling, yes. If someone is suspicious, his act is suspicious, I think it's very important that we follow that person. However, to go, and it does not work because you're just putting ourselves in a hole. We are alienating the community. 7 million community, we do not put trust in them. And I can tell you, the FBI actually, Director Robert Mueller stated in 2004, in response to the comment that Peter King made that time, and he said, and I quote, I should mention that the Muslim American, Iraqi American, and Arab American communities in the United States have contributed a great deal of our success. And on behalf of the FBI, would like to thank this community for their assistance, for their ongoing commitment to prevent acts of terrorism.
And finally, in both of you are American citizens. Your reaction afterwards and your feelings about how your government treated you in this situation?
I felt very humiliated and saddened because I was made to feel like an outsider in my own country. I'm a U.S. citizen. I consider myself American. I was going on vacation. That's all I was doing. I don't understand why I was made to feel like a criminal, like a terrorist. And it really does show you the direction that we're heading in. And I think that's why it's so important to speak out against it.
For me, I was really very sad. When we left Iraq, I went give my children freedom to come to the United States. But then at that time, I realized that's not happening. My children have to go through racial profiling and not feeling safe.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, Nagham al-Yaqoubi, Arwa Ibrahim, mother and daughter, for joining us, Omar Mohammadi, lawyer for the family, president of the New York chapter of the New York CARE, Council on American-Islamic Relations. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. Ornette Coleman here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to the situation in Sudan. It has now been 3 months since the signing of a peace deal between the Sudanese government and one of the war-torn Darfur region's three main rebel groups. The deal was touted by the international community as a possible end to the three-year-old crisis. But since the deal was signed, violence in the region has in fact increased. Yesterday, the Sudanese government rejected a draft UN resolution which called for a 17,000-member international security force to be deployed to Darfur.
In response, President Bush Thursday announced a senior U.S. official will visit Khartoum to pressure Sudan's government to accept the joint U.S.-British force proposal. The government in Khartoum has long opposed the idea of a U.N. security force, depicting it as a front for Western imperialism. We're joined in Massachusetts by Eric Reeves, a professor at Smith College, who's devoted nearly a decade to research, analysis and advocacy on the Darfur crisis. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good to be with you.
Can you talk about this latest news and the reaction of the Sudanese government?
There are many facets to Khartoum's decision. It's, to date, paid no real price for its obduracy, its refusal to abide by international norms, either in the North-South conflict, which nominally ended in January 2005, or in its genocidal conduct of war in Darfur. What I am hearing from my sources on the ground and what Hedi Anabi, the head of UN peacekeeping, recently said in a report to the Security Council that I have seen is that Khartoum is right now planning a massive military offensive in North Darfur, which has been the most violent of the three Darfur states. If this offensive takes place, there will be massive, massive civilian destruction. I think we're also likely to see a withdrawal of virtually all humanitarian workers. This will leave some 1.2 million people completely dependent on humanitarian aid without any assistance whatsoever. By my own calculations, some 500,000 people have already died, as many more could die in the coming year if current trends continue. Only with the deployment of an effective, and I emphasize effective, international force can genocidal destruction be brought to a halt. Khartoum gives no sign of capitulating on this, and I'll be very interested to know what Jendai Frazier, President Bush's envoy to Khartoum, takes with her in the way of sticks and pressures to bring to bear on this recalcitrant regime.
Well, what has happened with there is supposedly an international peacekeeping force of African nations there. What has been the problem so far with their ability to carry out their mandate?
First of all, we need to understand that the African Union force on the ground is a monitoring team per the April 2004 ceasefire. The Darfur Peace Agreement of May, negotiated in Abuja, Nigeria, nominally gives them responsibilities for protecting civilians and a whole raft of other tasks. But this force is undertrained, undermanned, under-equipped, badly led, has no interoperability. These forces have never worked with one another. It was a force created from scratch from the African Union Peace and Security Council. It's the African Union's first time out of the gate in a major peacekeeping operation, and they are far, far out of their league in Darfur. They have started to hunker down. They're conducting fewer patrols. They are themselves now under attack because they are perceived as having sided with one of the Sudan Liberation Army factions, the one that signed the Abuja Agreement. They are part of the problem now. They are they contribute very little to security in Darfur.
Eric Reeves, on the issue of the peace deal that was signed in May, we spoke afterwards to representatives of two of Darfur's three main rebel groups. Adam Mohamed El-Nour was a representative of the Sudan Liberation Army, represented the faction that signed the most recent peace deal, and Abdullahi Eltham was one of the negotiators for justice and equality movement at the peace talks in Abuja, Nigeria, in early May. His group did not sign the deal. I wanted to play for you a clip of that interview. I had asked both men to place the current peace deal in the context of the failure of the ceasefire agreement between northern and southern Sudan in 2004. This was the response of Abdullahi Eltham of JEM.
But why did the ceasefire fail? The first agreement you refer to, 2004, it failed simply because this is an essentially a political problem. You cannot ignore the political side and expect that by tampering with the security side that the problem will be over. That is the main problem. The government of Sudan, of course, continued violating the ceasefire throughout, but also saw some members of the rebel movement, and that is because the political side is not is not dealt with. And here we are moving into the same scenario also. And when I mentioned earlier that things have gone wrong and we are likely to go into a situation of a missed opportunity, the American ambassador in one of the last meetings, perhaps the 30th or 29th of April, came and declared that the security arrangement is within the national interest of the United States, but his government is not interested in the political issues and the wealth issues. So the focus has been also again being put on the security side, which is, of course, it's a fallacy because we went into the negotiating settlement because we realized that while there is no military solution for this problem, there is a political solution now.
Abdullahi Ultam of GEM, they rejected the peace accord. Your response to that, Professor Reeves?
First of all, I think it's important to recognize that GEM is not nearly so representative of the people of Darfur as the SLA, the Sudan Liberation Army movement. On the other hand, the comments we just heard are importantly accurate. The full-scale fighting that began in February 2003 in Darfur grew out of decades of political and economic marginalization, primarily in the last decade and a half of the people of non-Arab or African descent, non-Arab or African tribal populations of Darfur. Only a political solution and finally an economic solution, one in which the country's oil wealth is distributed equitably throughout this vast country. It's the size of the United States east of the Mississippi. But it is true as well that the Abuja agreement is very weak politically with respect to the needs of the people of Darfur. And also its security arrangements are deeply compromised by the fact that there are no real guarantees and, most consequentially, no guarantors. The African Union is the only contemplated guarantor of the very complicated security arrangements. Every single benchmark, every single deadline contemplated in the Abuja agreement has been missed. And in place of a disarming of the Janjaweed, the brutal Arab militia forces that have served as Khartoum's proxy, what we are seeing right now, as I mentioned earlier, is a massive military buildup by Khartoum that is intended to take on the non-signatory elements of the SLA. This will inevitably have, as I said, massive consequences for civilians, both in direct civilian destruction and in the inevitable withdrawal of humanitarian workers upon whom, in the greater humanitarian theater, Darfur as a whole, eastern Chad, the UN estimates there are some 4 million conflict-affected persons. These people are increasingly desperately in need of humanitarian aid. So the collapse of humanitarian operations in North Darfur would be catastrophic.
Could you talk also about the role of China and its impact in terms of the United Nations' ability to act on the situation in Sudan?
This is a key question at the moment. China is a net importer of oil, was as of 1995. Its petroleum needs increased by approximately 10 to 15% a year. That's a very, very large annual increase in the need for offshore oil. Sudan is China's premier source of offshore oil production. Not its primary source of oil, but primary offshore source of oil production. China dominates oil production in southern Sudan in both the two operating consortia. China will protect Sudan at the Security Council. There will be no deployment of a UN force that is not consensual, if we are to believe Kofi Annan, the UK ambassador, even the US. And Khartoum, understanding perfectly well that there is no stomach for passing a non-consensual resolution, also knows that China will veto anything that it declares inappropriate or unwanted. And the news headlines in Khartoum are consistently any United Nations Security Council member who votes for the US-UK resolution that follows very closely Kofi Annan's proposal based on a detailed UN Department of Peacekeeping operations assessment. Khartoum has threatened any nation that supports this resolution will be considered an enemy of the state of Sudan. China most definitely does not want to be considered an enemy of the state of Sudan. They will veto any resolution, and we come up against a very, very difficult problem. What will we do if the United Nations proves incapable of acting in the face of ongoing massive genocide?
Well, thank you, Professor Eric Reeves of Smith College. On Wednesday, the International Rescue Committee released a report documenting an alarming rise in instances of sexual violence in Darfur. 2 weeks earlier, more than 300 women living in Darfur's Kalma refugee camp convened a meeting to speak out against the spike in cases of rape and sexual assault. According to the IRC, more than 200 female residents of the Kalma camp have been victims of sexual assault in the past 5 weeks alone.
To discuss the issue of sexual violence in Darfur, we're joined by Heidi Lehman. She is a technical advisor for gender-based violence programs at the International Rescue Committee, has worked to set up gender-based violence centers in numerous areas, including Darfur. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
You've spent many months in Darfur. Talk about the spike in violence.
What we've seen over the last 5 weeks, I mean, let me just put it in some context. In the months preceding, what we saw was 3 to 4 reports of rape a month. Over the last 5 weeks, what we figured out was what we were seeing was about 40 rapes a week. Keeping in mind that is information from one camp of many throughout Darfur, keeping in mind the underreporting that is associated with sexual assault, we can surmise that that's actually a low figure, and that there are many more women and girls out there that have experienced this that have not come forward.
And how is this happening, this increase happening, especially in the presence that there are some African troops there supposedly monitoring and protecting the civilian population?
Well, I think, Mr. Reeves made a good point. The African Union forces on the ground are there for monitoring purposes. In May, there were several instances that caused the African Union to actually pull out of some of the major camps in Darfur, Kalma being one of them. That's why one of our recommendations in the press release is that the AU force on the ground must be much more robust and must restart what is being called the 24/7 patrols. So they're actually much more present in the camp. Another thing is that one of the things that the African Union did specifically to help prevent incidents of sexual assault was the firewood patrols. Those have stopped. There's only been one since April, I think.
And what are the firewood patrols?
The firewood patrols, these women are being attacked when they leave the camp. This leaving of the camp is most associated with firewood, and the AU patrols would be, the firewood patrols would be when the AU accompanies the women at a predetermined time to go out of the camp. And this was, to some extent, a protective factor from the sexual assaults.
On the issue of rape as a weapon of war, just before the show, we reach Jane Alao Odo. She is originally from the south of Sudan. She was displaced from the south early in her life. In 2004, she co-founded the Amel Center for the Treatment and Rehabilitation of Victims of Torture. In addition to providing medical support for victims, the Amel Center has attempted to prosecute the perpetrators of rape and torture. Jane talked about the legal obstacles to holding perpetrators of rape accountable. She also described some of the long-term effects of systematic rape on society. I wanted to play a clip of her discussion and get your response.
We do have three programs in Amel Center, legal aid, medical treatment, and the rehabilitation program. And these three services are free of charge for victims of torture. Legal aid, the legal department has seen more than 1,000 cases since the establishment of the center. That's 2004. And when we talk of rape in the sense of filing cases under Article 149, according to the Sudanese Penal Court of 1991, we have only one case that we've succeeded in convicting the perpetrator under Article 149. To prove rape itself, first of all, you have to prove that it was not adultery, That's according to Sharia law. And then after proving that it was not adultery, then comes the second step, that proving to prove that it was rape. And for this, it's not usually easy to prove such a thing, first not being adultery and then proving it to be rape, because it needs some other evidence that you need to have four male eyewitness that saw the penetration during the rape, that's the act itself. And that's usually impossible due to the fact that when those women or girls are raped, they're either raped in the forest, in the bush, far away from the grouping of people where nobody can see the rape itself. And thirdly, it needs the confession of the perpetrator. That's the person who raped, who did the act of rape itself. The widespread of rape or rape cases feature-wise and the torture cases feature-wise, that's the biggest challenge that people are going to face. Children born out of rape, they're going to face a real problem. And that's what people should be looking at future-wise. Women are raped during the attack of the villages. They're either raped in front of their community, in front of their families, in front of everyone in the area where they stay. So, and during the rape itself, the man who committed the rape itself, usually they kill people. So you find in a family the daughter was raped, the father either was killed, or maybe the brother, the aunt, and small children were even killed during the attack. So it's like you can't control such feeling. It needs some time for the wound to heal.
Jane Alao Odo speaking to us from Niala, a refugee camp in Darfur. A final comment, Heidi Lehman.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very important that we recognize the long-term impact of these sexual assaults on the women and girls and on the community as a whole, because it's not something certainly that the women and girls forget in the short term, nor the husbands or the other family members that are affected.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. We will link to all the relevant groups. The International Rescue Committee, Heidi Lehman, is the technical advisor for the gender-based violence program there. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
دلالة فينا بتمنى مالو بخاف قريب وبخطى هاتمنا
Music by the Sudanese artist Abdelghadir Salim. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez said Thursday he's planning to increase oil exports to China over the next decade to 1 million barrels per day. Chavez made the announcement after holding talks with Chinese President Hu Jintao in Beijing. Venezuela is the world's fifth biggest oil exporter, and the move is seen as an important step to reduce its dependence on oil exports to the United States. But the alliance between China and Venezuela goes beyond just energy. Chavez told reporters after his meeting that President Hu Jintao had expressed support for Venezuela's bid to join the United Nations Security Council. 5 of the 10 rotating seats on the council open up in October. One of them is traditionally reserved for a Latin American country. The United States is seeking to block Venezuela's bid for a seat and is backing Guatemala instead. The race between the two countries is to be decided by the General Assembly in a secret ballot in October.
China is the second of the Council's 5 permanent veto-wielding members to back Venezuela. Chavez won Russia's support last month. President Chavez said China's backing for the seat was, quote, very important from the political and moral point of view. We're joined once again by Mark Weisbrot. He is co-director at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He was at the United Nations yesterday speaking to people about this issue of the possibility of Venezuela becoming a member of the U.N. Security Council, something the U.S. is fiercely opposed to. Mark Weisbrot, what have you learned?
Well, I think everyone seems to think it'll be a close vote, but the striking thing is that so many countries have actually come out in favor of Venezuela publicly. The Mercosur countries, which is Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, and Paraguay, have publicly, the organization has actually endorsed Venezuela's bid. Bolivia also, now China and Russia, countries throughout the world. So it's quite striking because this is something that the Bush administration has made very clear. They don't want Venezuela in the Security Council. They've put a lot of pressure on countries. And here is Latin America saying, most of Latin America already saying, no, we're going to support Venezuela. So this is a tremendous slap in the face to the Bush administration because it's a very high priority for them.
And why would membership in the Security Council, especially since it's not one of the permanent members, be that important to the United States?
Well, they've got a lot going on there right now. I mean, they've got military threats against Iran, for example, and Venezuela is going to be very outspoken on that. That could actually make a difference. I think that's one of the reasons why Chavez wants to be on there. And then there's North Korea. There's all these things, a lot of things that you guys talk about on this show. Very, very important priorities to the United States. And they don't want an outspoken representative there who's going to say the things that maybe a lot of other countries would be afraid to say.
Can you talk about the significance of the China trip, both in terms of the UN and in terms of oil?
Well, the oil, I mean, Venezuela is planning to triple its oil exports to China within the next few years, but it's still, you know, it's maybe 500,000 barrels a day. It's significant. But they're still going to export probably 1.5 million to the United States as they do. So that relationship is not going to change all that much. But they are trying to diversify, and I think that's probably a very good idea from their point of view, especially with the enormous hostility they've been facing from the Bush administration.
Well, you made the point in a tremendous article recently about Latin America and the changes in Latin America, that Venezuela has begun to play an extremely important role in terms of financial backing, even of bonds and debt for other Latin American countries, and that this is really signals the defeat of the International Monetary Fund's sort of monopoly on international debt, especially in Latin America. Could you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, these are huge, really epoch-making changes that have taken place in the last 7 years or so in Latin America. I would, you know, if you adopt the Cold War terminology that policy analysts in Washington use, you could say it's kind of like the collapse of the Berlin Wall. And these are the newly independent states. And I think what's going on is that in the past, for the past 30 years at least, the major instrument that Washington has used to control policy and politics as much as they could in Latin America has been a monopoly over credit. And that was headed by the IMF. So if you didn't meet the conditions that the IMF set down, the policy conditions, macroeconomic conditions, privatization, things like that, it wasn't that you just didn't get loans from the IMF. You didn't get loans very often from the World Bank, from the Inter-American Development Bank, from the G7 countries, and sometimes even the private sector. So you could be really cut off. And that was the enormous pressure and the clout that they had, more than the military, more than the CIA, anything else in most cases. And that has totally collapsed in just the last few years. And this is, as I said, an epoch-making change. It's really changed the relationship between the United States and Latin America. And Venezuela's played a role in this. Argentina played a major role when they defaulted on their debt and said no to the IMF conditions and actually did very well. The economy's been growing over 9% in the last 3 years. But Venezuela has also entered the equation because they have provided an alternative source of credit without the kinds of, without any conditions, really. So they have $34 billion in reserves. Now, that's huge. I mean, if you look at all of IMF loans to the Latin America right now, it's only about $3 billion. So this is, and so Argentina, for example, when they wanted to say goodbye to the IMF, they borrowed $2.5 billion. From Venezuela. Bolivia is borrowing hundreds of millions from Venezuela. Ecuador is borrowing from Venezuela. So they've, and they've proposed to formalize this actually with a Bank of the South, and there's a chance that this may come to be in the next few years. But in the meantime, Venezuela is kind of the de facto Bank of the South, providing this alternative credit, allowing governments like Bolivia, for example, which a few years ago would have had a very short life expectancy because it could have been economically strangled, by the United States, to pursue independent policies and do what they were elected to do.
Mark Weisbrot, what about the relationship of President Chavez and President Bush as we move into this election here in the United States?
Well, I think the United States is usually a little more careful right preceding elections with Venezuela than they are otherwise. So I think as we get closer, they're less likely to provoke a tremendous confrontation because Chavez has said if you try to actually overthrow the government of Venezuela, he would cut off oil, and they wouldn't, I think, want that before this November election, which is pretty close. The same was true in the 2004 referendum in August 2004 in Venezuela. The United States kind of was a little reluctant to intervene there, and I think, but the there's still, you know, I think our government has really committed itself to regime change in Venezuela, and that's, you know, they supported the coup, for example, in April of 2002, and they haven't really changed their policy since then. Most people don't know, but the United States was really involved in that coup. That's documented. We have documents from the State Department and from the CIA that show that our government actually had advanced knowledge of the coup and not only didn't try to stop it, but actually tried to support it by telling the world that it wasn't a coup when they knew exactly what was going on, and trying to make the coup government stick, and trying to persuade other countries even to support it. So this is the kind of relationship that they have, and it really has not changed. And I think that's one of the other reasons why you see Chavez out there trying to support what he calls a multipolar world and trying to build support from other countries.
And let me ask you, what does it mean for the United States to be basically in a hostile relationship right now with two of the world's largest exporters of oil, Iran and Venezuela, in terms of what are the limitations of what the United States can do in that situation?
Well, I'm not sure it limits them as much as most people think. You know, these countries always sell oil. You know, Iraq, for example, when we had sanctions on Iraq and we're trying to get rid of that government, they were the second largest supplier of oil to the United States from the Middle East. And I think that's one of those myths, really, that people believe that our foreign policy is driven by our need for oil. But I don't think it would change very much if the United States were to become self-sufficient in energy, which would be a great thing. I'm not sure it would change our foreign policy all that much because it's not the oil per se that they're fighting for, but it's control over oil as a source of power. And here's one case where you can really see it. They lost control over Venezuela, one oil-producing state, and as a result, they've really lost enormous influence in Latin America because there's your alternative source of credit.
Mark Weisbrot, I want to thank you very much for being with us, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shifu Dokadoos, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Matei, Frank Lopez, Jen Utes, Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin, and Megan Whitney. Mike DeFilippo and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. We begin our Breaking the Sound Barrier 80-city tour throughout the country next weekend on September 1st in Provincetown, Massachusetts, on September 2nd, Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. And then we go to Milwaukee and New York. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.